You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Senate is wrapping up the trial of President Trump today with a vote on whether to remove him from office. We'll talk about the end of the process and how it could affect politics in the month ahead. Now, after years of often contentious debate and extremely strong feelings on all sides of the issue, Brexit is official and the United Kingdom is no longer part of the European Union. What that means for Britain and the EU will be hammered out through intense negotiations, but now that it is happening for sure, we're wondering, what could it mean for Wisconsin trade? Mark Rodehage is director of the International Agribusiness Center at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He has extensive private sector business development experience in markets around the world, including working with WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
How big a trade partner are the United Kingdom and the European Union for us here in Wisconsin?
So the European Union, if you take all 28 countries, soon to be 27,
right?
If you take all of them together, it's about $4 billion. So actually, it would be our second largest trading partner if you just looked at that aggregate number. Canada would still be our number one trading partner, still larger than that, quite large. UK is a much smaller part of that, certainly for overall products is about $750 million dollars. For ag and food products, is actually quite small. It's about $55 million.
Right. We sell a lot of stuff to the EU and the UK once we tease that out. But it looks like when it comes to agriculture, they drop out of the top five. Do I have that right?
They do. So if you look at all goods that we produce in Wisconsin, it's our number four trading partner in the UK. If you look only at the ag and food products, which would include lumber, the raw lumber and semi-processed, all of those products come up to be about the number nine trading partner for us.
Now, it seems, before we get into Brexit itself, it seems like that could be an optimistic thing, like, hey, there's room for growth here.
There is, because if you look at the imports that the UK does, especially for ag and food products, they're a net importer of ag and food. So they are several billion dollars of import for those products. A lot of that, 73%, comes out of the EU. So Wisconsin has a lot of room to grow in that, considering that we're only $55 million of that several billion dollar import.
Do we know what kind of agricultural products they like from Wisconsin the most?
I don't know that we know specifically what they like, but we know that in the top items, one of the categories, the official category name is miscellaneous edible preparations, which ends up being, interestingly enough, yeasts, but also sauces. Mm-hmm. So if you think of soy sauce, for example, we're a major producer of soy sauce in Wisconsin and several other of those prepared products, but also things like livestock genetics, the bull semen, wood, animal feed, meat products, vegetables, especially packaged vegetables.
Now, here we are with Brexit. We've been wondering for a long time what would the impact be, but it always seemed way off in the future. The future has arrived. What do we know or what are we looking at to figure out what the impact of Brexit is going to be for our exports from Wisconsin?
At the start, we're not quite sure.
Sure.
there's a lot of uncertainty around this, of course. But I think on balance, it would be positive because on the one hand, the folks in the UK are looking to be able to trade with other markets, and the EU agreement has made it so that they weren't able to do their separate agreements with other countries. The EU and Canada, for example, has an agreement, so they were part of that. However, on balance, we're seeing an opportunity. However, there are some items, some issues that might balance that the other direction because they still need to trade with their closest producers, which are in the European Union.
Have we been guided by a trade agreement with the European Union, something comparable to a NAFTA or the replacement to NAFTA, or are we just under the general guidelines of the World Trade Organization?
Exactly. It's the World Trade Organization. We have most favored nation status, so those levels. But you know, there are certain levels of tariffs across several products that oftentimes will make us less competitive, even though we may be cheaper because the dollar to euro exchange or the dollar to pound exchange is such that generally speaking, our products are cheaper for them. However, when you add those tariffs plus the transit costs, then we end up being less competitive. With an agreement, that potentially will make it more competitive for our producers here.
We're talking to Mark Rhoda-Hayes, director of the International Agribusiness Center at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, looking at Wisconsin's exports, especially when it comes to agriculture, and what the Brexit deal in Europe could mean for us here in Wisconsin. Mark, how much do we control our own destiny? How much can we promote our own exports as a state to a country like the United Kingdom?
A fair bit, really. We do that partly through trade shows, trade missions that the U.S. Department of Agriculture runs. In fact, in September of this year, we're planning to participate in the trade mission that they will be holding in September, 14th through the 17th. We're looking to invite some companies to go with us on that to be able to meet with their prospective buyers. And there will be other states along with us as well. But we can do that individually through those meetings. Oftentimes, we'll invite delegations of buyers from overseas to come in. So in all those cases, those are opportunities specifically for Wisconsin companies to promote the products. And then more broadly, things like what the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin does in promoting dairy products and cheese overseas in these major trade shows. I have to say that we haven't been as focused on the UK in the past, given the size of the market. However, as we look at this opportunity going forward, and that trip in September will help us better understand the level of opportunity, but also the areas, the product types that we should be focusing more on.
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, we do export a lot to the UK, but it seems to be a lot of high-value manufactured goods tends to be our specialty as far as the UK is concerned.
Correct. It's a big piece of what we do, and it's across the world. A lot of our manufactured goods are industrial and electrical equipment, scientific and medical equipment, those kinds of high-dollar value items. With regard to agriculture and food, it's some of those prepared foods. But also things like animal feeds, whey, for example, would be a major dairy product and a great opportunity for us. Lumber and wood products, those are all things that they're importing from a number of other places, and we could well be one of those places that they would be doing that from.
Now, you talked a little bit about how the state controls its destiny here. That said, what are you watching for at the federal level? If the United States and United Kingdom are negotiating some kind of trade agreement, what kind of things would you hope for in that?
We're looking for, and I think it's true across a lot of the states, especially in the Midwest, and these are points that have come from the U.S. Trade Representative's office that also works very closely with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So areas like geographic indicators, because those things, and we know it for words like cheddar. We make a lot of cheddar cheese. It's been that way for many, many years. And so things like that where it could be a non-tariff barrier by saying you have to change the name of your cheese to something else in order to be able to sell it here, yet that's
what
it's been
called. As happens in Mexico often, as I understand.
As it has done in the past to some degree, although the issue with those has been resolved more recently with the new USMCA and current agreements. And that can happen in a number of countries. But as we look at that, the geographic indicators – and there are fewer of those in the UK actually than in the EU in general. So that can be a positive for us. But also some of those sanitary and phytosanitary regulations, those rules around what we say is safe and what they say are safe. It's different in the EU, which the UK now is part of, but will be moving away from. Their challenge will be though that they'll still have to trade with the EU. And they'll want to sell products to the EU, so a number of those things will still have to align with that. So how do they manage two different sets of rules? They want to have things more harmonized to make it easier for their producers.
If I'm a dairy producer, a cheese processor, whatever, can I go to the state and say, hey, I want to sell to Great Britain, to the UK? Can you help me make sure I'm meeting their guidelines?
Absolutely. So what we do is we have a team of four people in the International Agribusiness Center. And two specialize in food, processed food products. Cheese is one of those, absolutely. And then two people who are dealing more with livestock genetics and livestock and feed and some equipment and the lumber products. So whatever your product category is, will help you to get to the person to at least understand what your needs are. We work with experienced exporters that are looking for very specific information, and we're helping to connect them with the right people, either within our own USDA or overseas. And then for the emerging exporters, we're helping them to just understand what those rules and regulations are. A lot of resource available for exporters in the state from the federal level, information from some of the organizations like U.S. Dairy Export or U.S. Livestock Genetics Export, Meat Export Federation. It's actually a pretty broad and diverse network of interwoven groups, whether they're agencies or nonprofit organizations that are working together to help Wisconsin – well, all companies in the U.S., but Wisconsin companies export more of their goods.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Rota-Hage is director of the International Agribusiness Center at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He joined us to talk about what Brexit can mean for Wisconsin exports. Coming up, we'll talk with a Wisconsin inventor who's making personalized technology for people with disabilities, including a paint catapult. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a Madison man who uses 3D printing to make customized devices for artists and crafters with disabilities. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an icy story.
Ice is a natural resource, and this time of year, Wisconsin is rich in it. In the 1800s, before refrigeration, the ice trade was a big business. Today, a Central Wisconsin Historical Society keeps alive the tradition of ice harvesting. Rob Mentzer brings us their story.
In 1911, the Milwaukee-area manufacturer Alonzo Pauling founded the Pewaukee Lake Ice Company. They got to work building one of Wisconsin's largest ice houses. It could hold about 35,000 tons of ice. This was state-of-the-art 20th century ice harvesting. But it didn't last. By the 1920s, the breweries that did stay in business during Prohibition could make their own ice. A decade later, the vacant ice house collapsed. But the business of harvesting ice didn't completely disappear.
How many inches you got over there?
How many inches of ice we got? 14?
That'll
do. At Nepco Lake in central Wisconsin on this January morning, the local Lions Club is having an ice fishing competition. The ice is dotted with tents and shanties. There's music and announcements on the PA. And this is where, every year, Mike Hittner and other volunteers with Historic Point Boss do an ice harvesting demonstration.
This is a labor of love. We want to get the feeling of the sore muscles that they must have felt and bring back something that was done years and years ago.
The volunteers saw the ice by hand and store it in an ice house without any artificial cooling, just the way Wisconsinites in the 19th century would have done.
Before the turn of the century into the early 1920s, this was a way that people got their ice because it was the only way to store things for the long term other than smoking it or salting it or something like that.
Janet Heister came out to watch the demonstration. She's thinking about the farmers and other workers who used to do this every winter in Wisconsin.
I admire their work ethic. I mean, geez, they could have been sitting by the fireplace and just, you know, but no, no.
So cut through the heart, cold and clear, strike for love.
The saws that cut through the ice are more than 6 feet tall. They're three times thicker than a woodcutting saw, and the teeth are set farther apart. The volunteers cut massive 60-pound blocks and use sharp tongs to drag them out of the water. You've seen this process if you've watched the opening song in the Disney movie Frozen.
There you go.
Beautiful, powerful, dangerous.
Oh, ice has a magic and we control. Stronger than one, stronger than 10, stronger than 100 men.
The ice trade went all over the world, and it changed people's lives in all sorts of ways. By the mid-1800s, most middle-class homes could not only preserve meat with this ice, but now they could also make their own ice cream at home. Don Matthews, the president of Historic Point Boss, says that technology still has its appeal.
What's really neat is children during festivals. We have them crank the ice cream maker, and we have them chop the ice, and they're just really enthralled with this ice.
What are you guys going to do with the ice?
Put it in the ice house, Don Wakeley.
The Historic Point Boss Ice House is a couple of miles away from Nepco Lake. Today, the volunteers drive rather than taking horse-drawn sleds.
Harvesting ice and keeping things cold has been going longer than refrigeration, so sometimes we got to keep some of those tried-and-true low-tech methods operating.
Tony Whitefeather farms at Whitefeather Organics in Custer, Wisconsin. He was volunteering with the ice harvest, but he says it's not just history for him. He's taking some of the blocks home with him.
For us on our farm, White Feather, we have put it in our walk-in cooler, and it saved us a couple months of electric bills.
The volunteers stack the blocks and cover them over with sawdust. They'll fill the whole room with sawdust for insulation, and there the ice will stay. They'll be making ice cream with it this summer.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story of ice harvesting on Wood County's NEPCO Lake. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, for artists with physical disabilities, putting their vision on the canvas can be a matter of having the right technology. That's where our next guest comes in. Last year, he set aside a career as a metal sculptor and started working with artists and other people in the Madison area to build devices that help them make their ideas a reality. John Lash is the owner and lead artist at Mad Design Works. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, you've worked for years as a metal sculptor. What led you to get interested in making devices, unique devices, for people, including artists, with disabilities?
Well, it wasn't so much getting interested in it as finally choosing to pursue that interest. Many years ago, I worked as a camp counselor at Camp Evergreen at Sheboygan, which is a camp that works with disabled individuals. And that's when I first became aware of the community. And I became aware at that time that there were many ways in which this community was not being well served. And then about 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with a disease called Kennedy's disease. It's a degenerative neuromuscular condition that, fortunately for me, is very slow to progress, but it has significantly affected my life. And those two things put together created and fostered this interest in assistive and adaptive technology. That, and I've always loved machines and moving parts and all of that. So combining all those interests has led me to where I am right now.
And I want to talk about one particular project that sounds super cool, a paint catapult for an artist. Can you talk us through this project a little?
Well, I was originally contacted by actually someone I knew back in Camp Evergreen. Jennifer Arnold is her name. And she knew that I was active as a metal sculptor and wondered if I could create something to help out this artist, Jeannie, with her painting process. She has only limited use of her left arm and really wanted to be a painter. She had a small catapult that she was using to throw paint at a canvas, kind of in the Jackson Pollock splatter paint style. But she didn't have a lot of control over direction and angle and force, and she wanted to expand her control, give herself a little agency in creating her own art. So I worked with Jeannie, spent a lot of time talking with her and trying to understand her process and what her goals were. And then I was able to create this catapult for her, and it was just a wonderful introduction to this world that I'm now immersing myself into.
I love this example because it would be one thing to mass produce a product that would kind of work for thousands of different people with a similar disability, and that's not what you did. You, it sounds like, really worked with her to try to craft something to her particular needs and interests, and that's how you work.
Yes, that is exactly my goal. 300 years ago, if you needed something built, you would go to the village tinker, and you'd be very close to that design and manufacturing process. But then along came the Industrial Revolution, mass production, economies of scale, and the process of designing and building has been slowly moving away from the end consumer. But I think we're at a point right now in technology where we can start to move it back towards that end consumer. One of the key things is the advent of additive manufacturing or 3D printing. This is a technology that allows you to very economically build very unique, very specific pieces in a reasonable time frame and without having to rely on the economy of scale to make it work. So that is one of the components that I think is going to help move manufacturing back to the people. And it's something that I'm very passionate about.
What other kind of projects have you done or in the works that are other good examples of this?
Well, again, for Jeannie, she came back to me and said that she wanted to get into flow painting, which is a process where you pour paint on a canvas and tilt and rotate that canvas to allow the paint to slide around the canvas, and it produces some fantastic patterns and results. So I was able to make a tilt table for her, again, using mostly 3D printing and a few store-bought components that allowed her to tilt and rotate a canvas with only limited use of her left arm, and it's worked out great for her.
When I think back of on the tinker you mentioned or the blacksmith, I imagine a feeling of the pride of the crafting in that. Is that something you get out of this, that feeling like you've made something unique that exactly meets the needs of the people you're working with?
Oh, absolutely. I truly love the process of design. It's something that I'm very passionate about. And my goal in design is to really focus on the user experience. So if I've created something that allows someone to do what they want to do without focusing on the technology, the mechanics that they're using, and really be immersed in their activity, when design becomes invisible like that, that's really when I feel that sense of pride. That's really when my passion has been achieved.
Now, you do a lot of your work, I understand, at a local maker space. For people out there listening, thinking, I've got that tinker in me trying to get mm-hmm. out, how would you encourage them to try to get started on whatever project is inspiring them?
Oh, there's a number of paths to follow. Certainly one of them is going to your local maker space, and we have two of them here in Madison, Sector 67 and the Bodgery, both excellent resources. But you don't have to go to a makerspace to do this. There is inexpensive or even free software available online that you can use to design whatever you want to design. And 3D printers are becoming very inexpensive, or you can pay a relatively small fee to have things printed for you. So I really believe that design is coming back to the people in that way.
And do you consider yourself a 21st century tinker?
Yeah, I would say so. And I'm very happy doing that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the story with us. I love the work you're doing and then the art that's coming out of it from the people you're working with.
It's really a great thing for me to be able to do. I feel wonderful being a part of the community in that way.
John Lash is the owner and lead artist at Mad Design Works in Madison. He talked to us about his work making adaptive technologies for people, in particular artists, with disabilities. Coming up, we'll talk about today's final vote in the impeachment trial of President Trump. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it doesn't seem like placebos should work, but sometimes they do. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on the placebo effect about why and when fake medications might work as well as the real thing, and when they don't. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Now, the U.S. Senate finished the impeachment trial of President Trump by voting to acquit him on both charges, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The vote fell largely along party lines, including from Wisconsin senators. Democrat Tammy Baldwin voted to convict Trump on both counts, while Republican Ron Johnson voted to acquit. One Republican senator, Mitt Romney, voted guilty on one of the two charges. The process has left some worrying that impeachment will be used more often as a partisan tool in the future, while others fear presidents will now be emboldened to use their office to help their personal political goals. Maurice Shepard is professor of political science at Madison College. He's with us now in the studio. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, before we get to Mitt Romney, the one asterisk probably on this question, anything surprising in the votes today to acquit the president?
Nothing really surprising in terms of the vote. I think there was one senator, Manchin from, Virginia, who there was some question in terms of how he might vote. He comes from a very conservative state, so there was some concern that, once again, he might vote on one of the articles to convict, but that did not happen.
So the end result hasn't really been in question at this point. Does everything just go back to normal now, whatever normal is?
Well, it will be a new normal. I think what in terms of the impeachment process, again, this is something that the American founders put in place due to their fear of having a too vigorous or even a tyrannical executive. In some of the political science literature, again, we've heard a lot about, you know, the issue that this is not like a criminal trial. This is really a political question. And the two things that really stand out in terms of the literature on this in political science would be, one, the politics of it. Who is in charge? Which party has a majority in, once again, in this case, in the Senate, in terms of, once again, having the trial? But also what matters will be, and I think this is important in terms of the impeachment of President Trump, even though he's been acquitted, will be the clarity and the perceived severity of the wrongdoing. And I think that was a major issue here.
Well, I want to give a listen to Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. He voted to convict the president on the first count, abuse of power. He said Trump's conduct was, quote, here's a bit of what he had to say on the floor.
Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine.
Now, Senator Romney's vote, of course, doesn't make a difference to the outcome, but the symbolic value of the guy who ran as the Republican candidate for president in 2012 now becoming, I believe, I keep hearing, the first senator in U.S. history to vote to impeach a president from his own party. Can you talk about the symbolism there?
Right. Well, this does provide where you have a president now who's been, again, at least voted against by someone of their own party. So it lends to the idea that there was bipartisan support for at least acknowledging sort of the wrongdoing on President Trump's part. I think it also matters in terms of the sort of politics for Governor Romney. He's placed himself in a pretty difficult position. It will be interesting to see sort of how he moves forward and what he actually can do.
And now he isn't running for re-election until, I believe, 2024 in the Senate in Utah. That's a long time from now. A lot could happen between now and then. So senators faced with an election in 2020 may have faced a different calculation.
Right. And again, there's always a balance there in terms of, and I think this was at the core of the entire sort of impeachment issue at this point, in terms of sort of civic virtue, in terms of maintaining and staying with the Constitution. What are your deep beliefs in that sense? But then also that has to be balanced with the reality of partisanship and politics. In the United States right now, we have, particularly at the national level, very intense political polarization. And we see that sort of coming through. The interesting thing in terms of that, I always find, is that a lot of that people are concerned about where does the polarization come from, I think. And some of the literature does show that most of it comes first and foremost from the parties themselves. So in some ways, they generate sort of this heat, and then it sort of radiates out. And when there are questions in terms of, you know, how can we address this issue? I think it really has to come back to the parties and the elected officials themselves.
Talking to Maurice Shepard from Madison College, looking at today's vote in the U.S. Senate to acquit President Trump on both charges of impeachment along party lines, with one exception, Republican Senator Mitt Romney voting to convict the president on one of the two counts. I want to give a listen to both of Wisconsin senators now, starting with Senator Ron Johnson. He doesn't see the president's actions as being impeachable. Yesterday he said he doesn't think they were meant to affect the upcoming election. Here's a listen to Senator Johnson.
I never viewed his desire to find out what happened to Ukraine as having anything to do with the 2020 election. It was all a look back, trying to explain in some way, shape, or form how he ended up with a special counsel.
And that's in contrast to Senator Romney, who saw the Biden part of the investigation as being about the 2020 election. So a different lens for those two Republican senators.
Right. And even in some of the interviews that have taken place recently with Republican senators, there seems to be a common thread in terms of, one, that for the first article of impeachment, abuse of power, a number have voiced the idea that even if the president engaged in this action, it was either one, by accident, or two, it's nothing. It's not a real big deal. The second article, though, that's where I think a number, and this is where, again, there really are some questions in terms of obstruction of Congress, in terms of executive power. And I think, again, putting politics aside, I think for many scholars, they believe that that question really should be decided by the Supreme Court. It's still sort of unclear in terms of how far, executive privilege, executive power, how far that actually stretches to the point where President Trump, again, asked a number of his officials not to, again, sort of respond to subpoenas and turn over certain documents.
And this has been an ongoing issue, before we get back to the current impeachment, an ongoing issue for presidents of either party. How much does the executive branch have to defer to the legislative branch, Congress? How much do they have to provide people and documents and things like this? This is an ongoing issue where a lot of people see the president's side of that getting more and more powerful.
Exactly. And this, and putting, again, putting politics aside, both the two dominant American political parties, you see this happening on both sides. So if the president is Republican or Democrat, that the presidency as an institution continues to grow in terms of its power. And that happens for a number of reasons. One, over time, the American founders did not necessarily, I think, intend for the president, for the presidency to be as powerful as it is today. They really wanted the Congress, the real representatives of the people, to sort of take the lead. Over time, executives, presidents have expanded their power, sometimes with congressional support and consent. In other cases, they can take advantage of maybe a crisis situation to, again, expand those powers.
I want to listen to Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Now, Senator Johnson has said when he asked President Trump about withholding aid to Ukraine, Trump said there was no quid pro quo. More recently, leaked writings from John Bolton said the president confirmed that quid pro quo, something that Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin talked about today. Here's a listen.
It may not matter to this Senate, but I can tell you it matters to the people of the state of Wisconsin that this president did not tell their senator the truth. Based on the facts presented to us, I refuse to join this president's cover-up, and I refuse to conclude that the president's abuse of power doesn't matter.
Now, what do you make of Senator Baldwin using some time there to focus on the conversation between her Wisconsin colleague, Senator Johnson, and President Trump?
I think she gets to the heart of, again, of American politics, that we have what's called sort of the Madisonian model, separation of powers, checks and balances. And that was one of the intention of the American founders, to separate that power, and also with checks and balances, that if a single branch of government, particularly in terms of the executive, starts to become too powerful, that there's an ability and a way to check it. Again, it's sort of the double-edged sword of the American politics, and particularly in terms of the Constitution. It's short, it's clear, it's concise, but it's vague in many areas, particularly as it relates to impeachment of a president.
I want to bring up a question. I've talked to some other guests. We've been talking about this a lot lately, of course. We had some Republican senators who said the president's actions were wrong here, but they don't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. And really, for oversight of the president, there's not a lot of room between doing nothing and removing them from office completely. There's not a lot of middle ground when it comes to putting consequences on the actions of a president if Congress doesn't like them.
Well, a couple of things there. One, in terms of Congress, it has a number of tools in its toolbox. Congress controls the appropriations process. Again, also in areas in terms of appointments and that sort. So there are a number of institutional mechanisms that Congress can use that if they don't really like the direction that a president is going, that they could, once again, sort of put the brakes on it, per se. But the other question is, yeah, in terms of politics comes into play here, and this is where, once again, sort of the political polarization kicks in. And for the Republicans right now, right or wrong, they are sticking with their president.
We're talking to Maurice Shepard right now, professor of political science at Madison College, looking at the final day of President Trump's impeachment trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the vote to acquit President Trump on both articles of impeachment? Do you think we could see impeachment being more common in the future? Are you worried that the acquittal might allow future presidents to get away with more, maybe, than the president was accused of doing? What do you think of Senator Mitt Romney crossing the aisle on one article of impeachment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Maurice Shepard of Madison College, looking at the final day of the Senate impeachment trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Senate's vote to acquit President Trump on both articles of impeachment? Do you think the process ran fairly? Has the impeachment process changed your view of the president, of politics, for better or worse? What do you think of Senator Mitt Romney, a Republican, voting to convict the president on the abuse of power charges? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steve starts us off in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think the elephant in the room on this is just the Democratic Party just being the party of hate. I mean, you can look at Wisconsin and what they did with Walker. Same type of deal. I mean, we can look at the State of the Union yesterday and the unhinged Nancy Pelosi ripping up the speech right in front of everybody for the cameras. It's all about hate. And just wanted to hear the guests comment on this hateful nature that's coming from the Democratic Party. Like, they have nothing else to offer except this hate that's out there.
Steve, thanks for the call. This is motivated by Democratic hatred for the president, he says, Maurice.
I think the issue in terms of the core issue here is political polarization. And quite honestly, this is nothing unique to the United States. There are other large-scale democracies around the world that are facing the exact same thing in terms of again, sort of the intensity of the politics instead of looking first and foremost at sort of the good of the country and the nation. The parties have sort of once again closed ranks, and that's what they focus on. Some could point back to when President Obama was in office and he was giving a State of the Union address, and I think it was a Republican, stood up and said, "You lie," or something along those lines. No hands are clean here. No one is totally innocent. This is something, again, it's a worldwide sort of phenomena that, again, not unique to the United States, but it matters.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. We'll go to Sharon now in Milwaukee. Sharon, hi.
Hi. My concern is that you had all these Republican senators that took this oath, that they took an oath knowing they were going to vote Republican party lines, and now that oath means nothing. So now no oath in the United States, including the president, means anything. So how do we go from there?
Sharon, thanks for the call. Maurice, do you think Republicans weren't true to their oath, or is there more to it?
I cannot see into their hearts. but I think you have an important question that needs to be addressed. And in our system of politics, this could be addressed and should be addressed during an election, that constituents will have to once again think about their, particularly as it relates to senators in this case, in terms of the Senate trial. Again, you know, do they feel that they were once again true to their word? Did they look at the evidence in an unbiased way, or were they just being partisan in terms of their behavior and their vote?
And I think there could be a little of both there. I think human psychology suggests that once we've picked a side, and not saying anything about Republicans or Democrats in particular, the arguments of that side start to look more persuasive to us, and the arguments of the other side look less persuasive to us.
Yeah, it can be very complex. I think what has sort of muddied the water, quite honestly, it would be some of the Republicans and their Republican senators and their comments in terms of, again, in some way, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, for example, acknowledging that, you know, yes, I think that the president, in terms of Article 1, did abuse his power. Mm-hmm. But as he put it, it doesn't rise to the level of, and the term he used was impeachability, which I have a real problem with that because the president has been impeached. Mm-hmm. It's just, once again, that happened in the House of Representatives. Now it's a question of, once again, the trial and, once again, guilt or innocence, convicting him and throwing him out.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. We're talking to Maurice Shepard from Madison College, looking at what looks to be the final day of the impeachment trial of President Trump. Back to your calls now. Harold is with us in northern Wisconsin. Harold, hi.
Well, hello there. I want to thank these Republicans. Have they voted on this now?
They have voted on it. Yep, they acquitted the president, mostly party line. Mitt Romney voted to convict on one charge.
Yeah, okay. I've been on the phone so much. they're really making it easy to clean house and impeach all these Republicans. It's just demoralizing. They're hanging themselves, and the joke is on them. They think they won, and they haven't won because we're going to just clean house, and they've ignored.
I think I gotcha, Harold. Harold looking ahead at the election, saying this is going to be bad for Republicans. I suspect anybody making really strong predictions, it may be a little fuzzier come November one way or the other.
Correct. If, once again, there are some who are, once again, lean right, they may say that this has blown up in the Democrats' face. And now, again, President Trump is in a much stronger position and that Republicans will be able to ride his coattails. There are others that would make the argument. I think this is sort of the argument that Harold is making, is that this is just, again, it's politics, it's personal politics, but where's the policy? You know, sort of if President Trump is, and again, just sort of looking at this as an outside observer, you know, if they're so focused on, again, sort of looking at the 2020 election, engaging in these questionable activities and behaviors, you know, where are the public policies that are there to address the American people, particularly here in Wisconsin? In Wisconsin, we have a terrible situation of, once again, teen suicides, once again, opioid abuse. Housing is an issue there, you know, a number of different issues. So there are, I think this is what Harold, again, is getting at, is that, you know, sort of where is the focus on the voters and what they want beyond just sort of politics?
Mm-hmm. Harold, thanks for the call. Kamal joins us now in Elkhorn. Kamal, hello.
Hi. My comment was that, you know, this trial was supposed to be a trial at the Senate and both at the House of Representatives was supposed to bring out the truth for the public. And I think that both parties failed in that. I think that the Democrats probably could have pursued the, you know, the information through the court system, which they try to take a shortcut. I also think that both parties was trying to protect their golden boys, Biden and Trump. I think when the offer was there, specifically when the offer was there that, you know, Biden's come and testify, supposedly to shed light on what was the true trigger for the president to make that call. I think that both parties sort of try to protect themselves in a way that prevented the truth to come out.
Kamal, thanks a lot for calling in. Maurice, I think there's a sense among a lot of people that there's a lot we still don't know and information keeps trickling out because, as he said, Democrats didn't take it to the courts to try to force witnesses to come. The Senate didn't call witnesses like John Bolton. There's a lot of testimony that might have shed light that we don't get now.
And again, the impeachment process is a political process. Just like the Republicans did not need to pursue impeachment of Bill Clinton, the same thing here, that the Democrats could have maybe just censured the president or, again, waited for the courts to answer certain questions, particularly in terms of executive privilege and that sort. So the truth is a slippery sort of issue. I don't know. Again, they would say that they're going after the truth, but it's taking place within a political process.
Thanks a lot for that call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Maurice, do you see between in an election year after an impeachment any room for the president and, say, House Democrats to work together on, I don't know, anything?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say no, simply because I think the politics are so raw. We saw this at the State of the Union last night where the president refused to shake Speaker Pelosi's hand. And at the very end, Speaker Pelosi sort of rips up, once again, a copy of the speech on television and in front of the world. So I think this is it's going to be very hard fought, once again, a political season.
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Maurice Shepard, professor of political science at Madison College. He joined us today for a look at the final day of President Trump's impeachment trial. The Senate ultimately voted to acquit the president on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, right down party lines, with the exception of Utah Senator Mitt Romney, who voted to convict the president on that first charge of abuse of power. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. travel ban will include new countries. We'll find out why and what impact it could have and look at possible challenges in the courts. Great Lakes water levels are really high. That means storms are doing more damage than usual for shoreline communities. A Wisconsin expert on coastal engineering joins the show for more. And romantic comedies were once one of the biggest box office standbys, then they fizzled. But there may be good news for fans. Our guest says we're in the midst of the rebirth of the rom-com. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, take a further look at the outcome of the Senate impeachment trial. Kate talks to an expert on American politics and then welcomes Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we count on science writers and reporters to bring complicated issues into the public eye. Our guest goes behind the scenes to tell us what goes into the craft of science writing. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.